Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. And tonight gives me great pleasure to introduce another new series, the European Championship. As the 60th anniversary finals approach this summer, us at These Football Times are launching a new six-part series looking back at the history of the tournament. And for part one, we're going to explore the 14 finals era of 60 to 76. We go from early Soviet endeavour through the first major success of Spain, and then we go onward to the redemption of Italy, the stylish West Germany of 1972, and then the shock and awe of Czechoslovakia and Panenka. For each episode, we're going to have a special guest, but before we get to tonight's special guest, it's going to come as no surprise to regular listeners who the two primary contributors are going to be for this series. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you?
Oh, we're very well, Stu. How's it going, Jolan?
Yes, very, very good, thank you. Looking forward to this. I believe this is probably going to be one of the best and easiest jobs that I'm probably going to have over the next few weeks. I've just got to throw in a couple of joining words and a couple of sentences and then just sit back and relax and press record. And that's about me done.
No, we're standing by for your legendary spontaneous question.
don't give me too much thinking time. That's the problem. That's the key to this.
No, it's you're more than that, Stu. Don't downplay your role in this.
And then second of all, for Mr. Gary Thacker, who is about to taste some of the English weather again, Gary, right?
That's true, but it's great to be on board again with the guys, and another great subject to talk about. And yes, I'm leaving my Spanish boat tomorrow to travel back to England to spend some time with my family over Christmas. So, I've got my wellies packed and
pack your thermals.
Pack my thermals
and waterproofs, yeah. And you'll be good.
Yeah, but tonight's going to be a nice warming thought, because we're going to talk about some great period of history of football.
Absolutely. And hopefully, well, obviously, as we always do, certainly myself, looking up at this before we started, I've already learned new stuff before we've even started. So hopefully the listeners as well. But obviously, the special guest, and this is just one of my favourite guys that we have on the show. He is just brilliant to listen to. And it's Mr. Paul McParland. Paul, how are you?
I'm fine, Stu. It's great to be on the show again. Looking forward to some questions from yourself. And I know that people I've referenced how difficult Andy Neil would have been if he quizzed Boris Johnson. I think he would have topped him, Stu.
Well, like I say, it's the thinking time that's the problem. That's where it all goes wrong. You just need to not give me thinking time. But yeah, great to have you. So before we start, I've got to say, really, you know, although it's a These Football Times production, if you like, but Stephen, you know, this was your idea. You're the one who sort of broached it to Gary and I about a potential series. So, you know, why?
Well, it's a couple of years since we did it now, but with our lost comrade Jim Hart, we did a wonderful series on the World Cup 2 years ago that we started around about now 2 years ago, and it was an absolutely brilliant odyssey that brought in yourself, brought in Gary and so many others that came and just had a lot of fun talking about the World Cups of the past. And back then, you know, me and Jim discussed saying, you know, we have to do a European Championship one. And so it had remained as an omnipresent idea that had to be done. And of course, Jim's not here to enjoy it with us, which, you know, we need to raise a beer towards him at some point during the series. But yeah, it was just a natural twin to the World Cup series that we did 2 years ago.
Brilliant. I mean, you know, we're talking about the European Championships, and you look at it this summer, Stephen, and it's, you know, it's becoming a mega event, if you like, in terms of its scope and scale. But before we hit 1960 and we look at the first one, it took a while, shall we say, from initial concept to the actual beginnings of the tournament, if you like. It was an idea that was kicked around for quite a while.
It was, well, the man whose name's on the trophy, Henry Delaunay, you know, he'd been one of the prime movers, along with Jules Rimet, in the birth of the World Cup. And his roles with both FIFA and UEFA, you know, he came up with the idea of a European championship as far back as the mid-1920s. And the same for the kind of like the European club competitions. He was a massively forward-thinking personality. A very varied personality as well. He'd refereed. There's a bizarre story of his refereeing days where he was reportedly hit in the face with a ball while just about to blow the whistle. It broke two teeth. He swallowed the whistle and ended his refereeing days in the most spectacular manner possible. And went on to become a bureaucrat instead, sit behind a desk safely away from flying footballs, but where he could dream up these competitions that should exist. And, you know, there was a reticence for it, which is the surprising thing in a pan-European manner. You always expect kind of like the English FA, the Scottish FA of those eras to say, no, we're not taking part. But it's quite surprising that it took so long for a European tournament, European international tournament to take root, really. And there'd been a South American equivalent since 1917, you know, so for it to wait as long as it did, and the first European Championship coming 30 years after the first World Cup, they were very slow out of the blocks, but the idea was there very, very early.
Well, at least it only took us 2 years from the World Cup one to us running the European Championship ones. At least we're running a little bit quicker than UEFA.
Yeah, indeed.
So, obviously, we'll start with 1960 then. Paul, we'll come to you first. Like I say, it's been a long time since we've heard you on here. 1960, and, you know, as Stephen mentioned, it's a four-team tournament. It's as far away from the tournament next year, sorry, should I say, in 2020. It's as far away from 2020 in terms of its size and scope as it could ever be.
Yeah, I mean, the tournament in 1960, Stu, is unrecognisable from the NC it's become these days. And going back to what Stephen was saying there before, you know, it is inconceivable that it took so long for the European nations to get this tournament organised. And I think even after the first idea, you know, was finally given approval after the creation of, I think the creation of UEFA in 1954 was the key element in getting this competition on the road. And even though they approved the competition in 1955, it took about 1957 to actually get it past the committee stage for it to become a competition proper. And they did have a stipulation for the first competition that the tournament would not go ahead unless they had 16 teams competing. And at one stage, they were down to 15 teams, and it looked as though it could be touch and go. But in the end, another two countries joined. So we end up with 17 teams taking part in the first ever competition. And it was quite a strange format with it being 17 teams, because it meant there had to be a playoff game before the competition could start. But I think more noticeable were the teams who didn't take part. No team from the UK took part, you know, which, considering they'd done so well relatively in the 1958 World Cup, was quite surprising. Sweden, the World Cup runners-up, didn't take part. We're not quite sure why. So the competition was quite depleted. And, you know, without the participation of the Eastern Bloc countries, who formed eight of the competitors of the original intake, the competition would never, ever got off the ground.
It's funny putting up Gary. Paul's just mentioned there, and you look at, you know, you have this qualifying tournament, and you end up with this sort of four team finals, if you like. You know, like Paul's just said, it's Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, the Soviet Union, and France. And again, if you compare it to today's finalists, if you like, although we're going to the 20 team one, but when we look through the eight team tournaments, you know, it is incredibly sort of Eastern European dominated.
Oh, it absolutely is, buddy. And, you know, Paul's hit the nail on the head. And, you know, aside from the teams he mentioned didn't complete, there was no West Germany, there was no Italy, there was no England competing, and there was no Spain because of the political, bias of Francisco Franco, who was in charge of the Spanish government at the time. I'm sure Paul will fill us in a bit more detail this time, because he was living in Spain at this time, I believe.
I wasn't quite then, Gary. I was five.
No. Forgive me. He spent some time living in Spain. That's what I should have said. Sorry, buddy. You're not that old, mate. You're not that old. I am. You're not. But you've got to sort of a first-hand Spanish experience of the political ramifications of it. But this is Spanish Civil War ended in 1939. But the Soviet Union were the prime backers of the Second Republic of Spain, the Civil War, and Franco decided that Spain shouldn't compete against the Soviet Union because of that. And strangely enough, 4 years later, he took a different view of it. But I want to just pass on to Paul, because I'm sure Paul will give us a bit more details about that, the sort of ramifications of Spain not competing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a strange decision from Franco. I mean, you covered the background to there, Gary. I mean, the USSR, as was then, were one of the main supporters of the Spanish Second Republic, and Franco never quite forgave them for that. There was also a complication as well, because, as you know, during the World War itself, Franco was quite a canny negotiator, both with Hitler and with Mussolini. And although he did not see formally join the war on the Axis side, he did agree to send a contingent of the Spanish army to fight for the German army in Russia, called the Division Azul. I think
that's correct.
40,000 Spaniards went to fight on Hitler's side against the Russians. Now, because of that, when the Second World War ended, at least sort of 7,000 Spanish combatants were still prisoners of war in Russia. They were still prisoners of war in Russia in 1960, so that was a complication for Franco as well. And he was adamant that, you know, he couldn't have the Spanish team going to, you know, playing against the Russian side and giving credibility to a government that he felt, you know, was imprisoning Spanish citizens. So that was a complication for him as well. I think the other thing was, from his point of view, prestige-wise, propaganda-wise, to be seen to lose a football game to the Soviet Union would be, you know, wouldn't reflect well on the fascist governments of Spain at the time, given the message they were sending to their people about Spain being the best country ever and Franco the greatest guy ever. So there was that to consider as well. And I think from his point of view, he made a miscalculation, and he kind of thought that he had more to lose. It's a bit like Boris Johnson around and the others. He had more to lose than to gain from Spain taking part in this contest. And whereas in the past, Franco, you know, but when you think this was a unique opportunity for Spain, because they had the best club team in Europe in Real. Seven of the Real team would have been in the Spanish team. And the likes of Di Stefano, Ferenc Puskas were representing Spain at the time, so they had a really good chance of winning that trophy and possibly could and should have done. But those players were absolutely left distraught by the decision of Franco not to allow the team to compete in that competition. And apparently the team had gathered to fly out to Moscow on the Tuesday. They're going to fly there on the Wednesday, when an official from the government came in and said, the game's off. The team looked wise off of orders from above. Franco doesn't want you to play. And that was it. Incredibly, the withdrawal decision wasn't even mentioned in the Spanish press. All that was mentioned was a line to say that USSR had progressed to the semi-final, with no explanation of how that had come about. So the whole thing was just buried by the media, which is under state control, which in modern times seems an incredible state of affairs. But that's how Franco got to be the longest serving dictator in Western Europe, with the amounts of power he still had over the media and the governments and the footballing population at the time as well. So Spain's opportunity of winning that competition just went. And from the Russians, it was a propaganda coup, because they were portraying Franco as being a puppet of the USA. And I think Khrushchev said at the time, I'll read the quote, "The whole world is laughing at Franco from his position as a right-sided defender of America's prestige. He has scored an own goal, and he's made Spain the laughing stock of the world." So propaganda-wise, It was an absolute disaster for Franco, and I think he was just badly advised. It was a poor decision, and the players in that team, Alfredo Di Stefano in particular, never ever forgave Franco for that decision.
This is why I decided it was a good idea to pass it on to you, Paul, because you've absolutely nailed that there and then, matey. And you know, if Spain had competed in that tournament, it would be difficult to see them not winning it because of the players they had there. And you know, and 4 years later, you know, I'm sort of jumping ahead a little bit there, but you know, they had players, well, the guys you mentioned there, but they had Luis Suarez as well,
the original Luis Suarez.
Who sort of was the so-called archetypal Spanish hero. And, you know, it's difficult to imagine Spain not beating the Soviet Union in that tournament. But politics and football, you know, what are you going to do?
The Spanish manager of that team was Helenio Herrera. So you had the world's best manager there as well, in addition to having some of the world's best players. And you know, there were kind of rumors going around that Spain had offered to play the home leg on a neutral ground, or they wanted both legs to be played on a neutral ground. But in the end, FIFA and the USSR refused to allow that to happen. And then because the USSR made a financial claim against Spain, because they said the Moscow was a sellout, and you know, they were losing money hand over fist because of this. Spain were kicked out of the competition. They weren't kicked out of UEFA, but they were kicked out of the competition, which meant they had a lot of bridges to rebuild if they were going to compete in 1964.
Definitely, yeah.
It is. I mean, obviously, you know, we will come to, because obviously, like you say, as you touched on there, Gary, you know, the story about Spain, you know, links brilliant to the next tournament. But I've got to say, looking at bringing in Stephen, and you've got to look at the first semi-final, and it's got Stephen and I's interest written all over it. It's a 5-4 it's a 5-4 thriller, you know, between Yugoslavia and France. And, you know, like we say, you know, the Soviet Union go on to win it, but certainly for someone like you, Stephen, who a big fan of Eastern Bloc football, you know, should we say, it was a tournament that unfortunately was sort of over in 4 days, and yet, you know, there were so many goals, so many, you know, so many elements to enjoy. And obviously you have Lev Yashin, you know, in goal. It's, you know, and the guys there have mentioned players who weren't even at the tournament, and it almost seemed not like a missed opportunity, but you look at the potential of what could have been within that early tournament to have really set a benchmark.
Yeah, well, that was it. I think the tournament it's not taken seriously across the board, is it? But you look at the finals, and the finals are just absolutely fantastic. And that's the story of certainly the first two tournaments, is that the qualification section is just kind of, you know, taken at, you know, far from seriously. But then those who reach the finals really go for it, and I think they do straight from the start. I mean, this game between Yugoslavia and France at 5-4, you know, France led 3-1 and 4-2, yet, you know, Yugoslavia have this epic four-minute span from, like, the 75th to the 79th minute where they just score three goals. It just wipes France away. This is a French side that were World Cup semi-finalists 2 years earlier, but it was a Yugoslavia side of immense purpose as well. You know, they'd been World Cup quarter-finalists themselves 2 years earlier. They would go on to the 1962 World Cup and reach the semi-finals. You know, in 1968, they would be back at the European Championship final. You know, Yugoslavia, one of these. You know, there's so many eras of the Yugoslav side that are celebrated, and that side in the early 90s, which we'll come to later in the series, that were denied the chance of playing at Euro 92, that people think, particularly Yugoslav vintage, was absolutely outstanding. And to get to the final in the style that they did against, you know, a very good French side as well, which, you know, interestingly, Robert Herbin was part of that French side, the man who would lead Saint-Étienne to all of those fantastic successes throughout the 1970s and be such a forward-thinking coach. You know, he was. I'd love to know just how much, you know, inspiration that Herbin took from that Yugoslavia side to add into his future coaching career.
It is. I mean, again, you know, clearly we could have done an episode probably on each of these tournaments, but I suppose, Paul, you know, I'll come to you to sort of pick up the story. And obviously we go 64 and we actually go to Spain for the second edition of this tournament.
Yes, can I just say one final thing about the 1960 competition?
Yeah, because
the referee for the final was Arthur Ellis, the man who hosted It's a Knockout in the 70s.
You see, this is why you're on, Paul. This is it.
I don't know if that name means anything to you, but I know he was the linesman in the 1950 World Cup final as well. But in the 70s, him and Eddie Werning were the star attraction on terrestrial TV. You know, we'd never had it so good, apparently. So going to 1964, I think the first thing is the competition had been just a success in 1960, so it was given the go-ahead to continue. I think 29 teams entered this time, so the intake had almost doubled compared to 1960. And then I don't think West Germany competed in the competition, and I think Cyprus and one or two other nations didn't compete, but Italy competed. And of course, the big thing from our point of view was, in addition to the Republic of Ireland, who competed in 1960, all the home nations entered the competition at this stage. Now, I know in Gary's excellent book, Cheers, Tears and Jeers, about England's international life, England played France over two legs, if I'm correct, Gary, and drew the first leg 1-1 at Hillsborough, and Ray Charnley of Blackpool had the honour of being the first England player to score in a European Championship, if I'm correct.
God bless you, Paul.
That's it's a mine of information, I assure you. And then, of course, we lost the second leg 5-2 in France with a catastrophic performance by keeper Ron Springer, by all accounts. And that was the end of our interest. But I think Spain progressed to the final by beating both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, was the way the competition worked out. And if there's any Hartlepool United fans listening, you'd be delighted to know that Ambrose Fogarty became the first Hartlepool United player to receive an international cap when he played for the Republic against Spain in the quarterfinals of that competition. Now,
go on.
Honestly, in Hartlepool, Ambrose Fogarty is a legend, I can assure you. In the preliminaries, the biggest shock was Luxembourg beating Netherlands, knocking them out over two legs. So, obviously the Netherlands, footballing-wise, weren't quite the power they were later to become. But even so, in the 1960s, them to losing against Luxembourg was an absolutely catastrophic result. Spain's progress to the final, I mean, they made a conscious decision after the poor showing in the 1962 World Cup in Chile to ban foreign players from playing in the Spanish League and also to not allow likes of Di Stefano and likes of Puskas to play for the national team. So the national team arguably wasn't as good as the one that didn't compete in 1960. But nevertheless, as a team, they played to their strengths. And once the draw was made for the semi-finals and Spain were chosen as the hosts, and apparently Spain were going to be the host in 1960 as well, but with their withdrawal affected that. Franco had a big decision to make in terms of what was going to happen, whether he was going to allow the competition to take place there. And it was they'd obviously kind of worked out there was a strong possibility of facing the Soviet Union in the final as well. So it was kind of the rerun of the situation in 1960. But they took a more positive approach to it this time, kind of propaganda-wise, and some of the new technocrats who were joining Franco's government and getting into positions of power were quite adamant that the country should go ahead and host the competition. Now, up until the day of the final itself, and obviously the two teams in the final were Spain and the Soviet Union, finals being held in Madrid as well. Just prior to that, just go back a little bit as well. In the semi-final, USSR being based in Barcelona, and apparently the Russian team, when they're walking through Barcelona, were quite surprised by the number of teenagers and young adults who spoke to them in Russian, because in 1953, after Stalin died, Khrushchev agreed a deal with Franco for some Spanish refugees from the Republic who'd gone to live in the Soviet Union to come back into Spain. And apparently they got behind the Russian team in Barcelona, which was kind of thing Franco was scared might have happened in 1960. It actually happened 4 years later, and that was beyond his control. So, Germany, I'm having the conversation here. I don't want to be a history lesson.
No, it's right, Paul. This is why you're on. Great. Don't worry about that.
Okay, so the final itself, there was some uncertainty whether Franco would actually attend the final or not. But he did attend. He attended the company. He attended with his wife as well. But a lot of planning had gone on beforehand to make sure everything would be just so. Now, allegedly, one of the stories is that a member of Franco's party was so concerned about Spain losing the game and the loss of prestige that would cause the country. He investigated the possibility of whether they could dope the Soviet team before the game to ensure that Spain could actually win the final and Franco can get the glory. Now, it's a story. It may be true. It may not be true. But there seems to be a fair amount of evidence to kind of support that view that that was definitely something that was seriously being considered as well, which is, you know, when you think about it, it's just unbelievable, isn't it? But sadly, Franco probably could have got away with that, such was his control at the time. Going back to the referee of the match again, just to digress for a second, the referee was a guy called Arthur Hollands, who was an ex-coal miner, apparently, and he was getting, after the match, criticised by the Spanish press because he disallowed a goal for Spain, and when the player, I think it was Pereira, protested quite strongly, he literally gave him a forearm smash to the chest and knocked him to the ground and carried on playing. So you couldn't quite see a modern Premier League referee doing that these days. And he was actually 57 at the time. I mean, you know, it's hard to remember the time when referees were that old. And it's a total digression there. Yeah. Spain, it was a very, very, very tight game. Estimates of the crowd vary from 70,000 to 120,000, depending on which source you refer to. But if you watch the game on YouTube, it's a very close game. Spain Spain scored after 6 minutes. Iribar, the legendary Spanish goalkeeper, makes a really poor mistake after 8 minutes for the USSR to equalise. The game's really tense in the second half, and then Spain win with a brilliant diving header to seal the game 2-1 to win the trophy. At the end of the game, the Spanish manager, Villalonga, offered the victory to General Franco and praised General Franco for his role in the victory. So obviously Franco's tactics, you know, he had a side we didn't know about there. And at the end of the game, all the security officials were making sure that everyone was waving Spanish flags, chanting Franco, Franco, Franco as a propaganda coup. And the fact it was beamed around Western Europe to 15 countries as well, Franco just saw this as a massive, massive victory for his style of government. And the fact that the players dedicated the victory to El Caudillo, to their leader, it almost has, you know, overtones of Hitler and the 1930s and the Olympic Games and the like. So quite frightening times. And there's a school of thought as well that victory, although it was great for Spanish football, it actually set back Spanish society because by that time, Franco was 72. He was starting to consider easing his grip on power, but apparently he was so infatuated by the response of the crowd and the fact that they'd actually beaten the Reds to win the competition, he decided to renege on any sort of changes to his government and remained with the same style of dictatorship for the next 11 years or so.
I mean, Paul, you know, absolutely brilliant. You know, superb knowledge and detail and context, and for a layman like myself, Gary, it almost seems like the first two sort of editions of the tournament was almost like a subplot between Spain and Russia, politics, and everyone else were just mere bystanders and spectators.
Yeah, it just seems like that, and excuse me, Paul captures the, you know, the essence of the moment really well. And, you know, it's interesting to note that the Spanish team that won the trophy were probably a lesser team than the team that Franco wouldn't allow to compete for the trophy 4 years earlier. Although, as I mentioned earlier, you know, sort of Paul echoed as well, you know, Luis Suarez was captain of the team, and he's the guy who picked the trophy up for Spain. And I think at that time, I think he'd left Barcelona and gone to Inter.
He had, Gary.
He was
definitely playing
Italy
at that time, yeah.
Yeah, he was playing for Herrera, because Herrera
he was.
Part of the grand Inter team, and we'll sort of come on to how that sort of Inter team became a part of the team that allowed Italy to to triumph 4 years later. But it's interesting to note that the politics of the first two competitions almost overcame the sporting aspects of it, because it was still in its nascent years, and it hadn't taken up on a personality of its own, a life of its own, where it could become a dominant event of its own. So after 64, things began to move a little bit forward from there, and it was almost like a transition thing. And as Paul mentioned about Franco, it was a weird thing where the politics almost overcame the football. I didn't almost overcome the football. The politics definitely did overcome the football.
We should do a series, yeah, Gary, yeah, I mean, on politics in football.
We should do that.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, we should do that.
Okay.
Sorry, Paul.
I mean, to get away from politics slightly, I mean, I think also as well, the Russian performance in that competition kind of laid the foundation for them doing so well up in 1966. And I think that Russia at that stage were definitely using the European Championship as a way to improve their performance in World Cup competitions in a way that other countries at the time weren't quite doing.
It's a good call. I just chuck in there that, you know, the Soviet Union won the 1960 tournament.
Yeah.
They finished runners-up in 1964,
yeah,
and were fourth. They were a damn decent team.
Yeah, and then finalist again in 72.
The
Soviet Union were absolutely magnificent in those early tournaments. And, you know, even that, you know, it was interesting that they didn't qualify again until 88. And then when they did, they got to the... There was just something, you know, magnetic for the Soviet Union and the European Championships.
Yeah.
Before we move on to 68...
Oh, sorry,
go on, Paul, yeah.
Yeah, well, one last thing, just I've got to mention as well. One of the things that Franco obviously was worried about was if the USSR had won the competition, he would be seen on TV beamed across Europe shaking the hands of the Soviet captain and handing the cup over to the Soviet captain. And, you know, in his worst nightmares... That was a scenario he was desperate to avoid, absolutely desperate to avoid.
the politics, you know, Gary and I, like I say, we spend, made a living out of doing this on a Sunday night, talking about politics and football. But Stephen, I've got to let you have the last word on this tournament. And obviously, Denmark just seemed to be a forgotten nation in this story of the 64 edition.
The people completely disregard the fact that this was, you know, a tournament that Denmark qualified for. You know, people will fast forward to like Euro 84 and say this is the birth of Denmark as a national team. But yeah, there was some sleight of hand, but you know, there was a parting of the ways for Denmark to be able to get so far in the tournament. You know, they played like Malta, Albania, and then Luxembourg, who'd overseen the Netherlands. So, but even within playing, you know, Luxembourg in what were basically the two-legged quarterfinals, they still needed a third game to get past Luxembourg. It was so, so close to being Luxembourg reaching the semi-finals of the 1964 European Championships. And I think that would have been just mind-blowing for anyone now to consider that. You know, what a story that would have been. It's a hell of a story for an amateur Denmark to reach the 1964 European Championships, you know, finals. But I think it's one of the great lost stories is how close Luxembourg came to getting there as well. But yeah, this Denmark, you know, they got there and were clearly massively out of their depth, you know, brushed aside with ease by the Soviet Union in the semi-finals. And to be fair, they did take Hungary to extra time in the third place playoff. So, you know, they clearly could play, but they were very much a surprise element. And yeah, I can't help but smile, but over Denmark's attendance in the latter stages of that tournament.
I thought, like I say, I had to get them in there for you. Right, Gary, we're going to move to 68. We're going to fast forward 4 years, and now I'm going to say we're starting to enter your era of football in terms of all the things that you admire. And obviously, it's in Italy. Without spoiling the surprise, it's an Italy win. Talk to me.
It is, but it was anything but straightforward. So obviously we're looking at Italy post 1966 and Pat Duvic and the great sort of turmoil for the Azzurri after North Korea defeated Italy. They were eliminated in the early stages of the 96 World Cup and went back to Italy, and there was a shortage of tomatoes required for the pasta sauce because they were all thrown at the Italian footballers on their return. And obviously the manager, Favre, was dismissed by the Italian Federation, and they had this crazy idea about forming what they called a technical committee, which was formed by Herrera, who Paul and I spoke about earlier, who was managing Inter at the time, and Valcareggi, Ferruccio Valcareggi. They sorted it out a little bit, sort of fairly quickly, and it's okay, so Valcareggi should be the guy. You can't have two guys managing the Italian football team. So they settled on Valcareggi. And Italy, as the host nation, they were almost sort of, it was deemed that Italy must win this, they must win this tournament. If they're going to have a renaissance of Italian football for the Azzurri, they must win this tournament. And they got through the qualifying tournament. They only lost, they didn't lose any games, but five of the six games they played, they drew against Switzerland in Bern, I think. But they had this guy coming through their team who was later to be christened as the Roll of Thunder. He was Luigi Riva. He scored six goals in the last three games of the qualifying tournament. But when he got to the final four in Italy, the coronation sort of fell a little bit flat. They played the Soviet Union the first semi-final, and after a 0-0 draw, the game was decided on the flip of a coin. I mean, this isn't extra time.
It's incredible, Gary, incredible.
It's crazy, Paul. This is not a replay, it's not penalties, it's not who's at the most corners, the most free kicks. A flip of the coin, so it's blue and red, and the coin was flipped in the air, and it came down for the Azzurri. So they got through to the final, and they would play Yugoslavia, who defeated England in the other semi-final. And in that game, Alan Mullery became the first guy to be sent off for England in an international game.
And that's in your book, Gary.
That absolutely is, Paul.
That's in the book.
Is your book sponsoring this show, Gary?
What's the title of the book again, Paul?
I think it's Cheers, Tears and Jeers.
It absolutely is, and it's available for all Christmas gifts for anybody interested in
football. Oh, brilliant.
Particularly.
Yeah, and it's still on offer that with Amazon.
It's yes, boys, thank you.
So for the younger reader, it's ideal.
It absolutely is. But moving swiftly along. So England actually got beat by Yugoslavia, and Alan Mullery actually said that Alf Ramsey paid his fine because he thought it was ridiculously unfair because the England player has been kicked uphill and down Dale, apparently, or whether that's true, I don't know, but Alf Ramsey paid his fine. But the referee in the final was a guy that England fans should know very well, Gottfried Dienst, who refereed the World Cup final in 1966 and awarded Jeff Hurst. Wasn't it over the line? It probably wasn't over the line, but shh, don't say anything too much about that. He refereed the final, and Yugoslavia scored first, and they were on the way to winning the game. And later in the second half, before Italy equalised, there was what's been described as variously blatant and obvious, a clear penalty for the Yugoslavs, but Dienst didn't give it. Now, whether you would describe this guy as a homer referee, I don't know, but you know, contemporary reports of the game suggest it was pretty clear penalty. However, it wasn't given, and Italy equalised, and then they had a replay, and after changing a number of players in their lineup for the replay, they overcame a very tired Yugoslavian team 2-0 to win the trophy. And it kicked off the Italian renaissance of football. Obviously, a couple of years later, they lost the World Cup final to that great Brazilian team. But how strange these things happen in European championships.
Yeah, I mean, you're going back to that one, Gary, as well. I mean, you summed that up brilliantly there. And certainly, a foreign referee giving a decision in favour of the Italian national team in a final, that doesn't really ring true, does it?
But you can't believe that.
No. But knowing the qualification stage, I mean, there were some strange anomalies in this competition because The four UK home nations were in the same qualification group, weren't they? It was the home internationals over 2 years, basically.
That's right.
And although we lost 3-2 home to Scotland in the first season of that, the 1-1 draw that England obtained at Hampden Park actually qualified through to the next stage, the quarterfinals. In the quarterfinal, England met Spain, so you had the World Cup champions playing against the European nation champions as well. And I think it's a measure of how well England were doing at that time in international tournaments that England came through both of those legs and progressed to the semi-final stage in Italy.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, Stephen, it's great. I mean, Paul's mentioned a great point there. You know, England, you know, current world champions. Do you think that's a missed opportunity for England?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, it was the only four-team European Championship that England qualified for. They fell short in every other one, and they were world champions at the time. You know, so it was. You know, but having alluded to how good that Yugoslavia side was, you know, it wasn't an easy for them in that semi-final. But it was definitely a missed opportunity. And as Paul's mentioned, you know, Italy did kind of labour through the tournament. They laboured the way to winning this, even down to kind of like the qualification. This is where the group stage qualification was introduced, and then teams would win their group and progress to the quarterfinals and play these two-legged quarterfinals to reach the finals, the 14 finals. And even in the quarterfinals, you know, Italy kind of laboured somewhat with Bulgaria. They lost in Sofia 3-2 and then won in Italy 2-0. And it was interesting with the goalkeepers. You know, we look back retrospectively, and you can look at the lineups for those finals, and Dino's off plays in goal, and you don't blink now, but he was the second choice Italian goalkeeper.
It's, I mean,
1970 World Cup finals was Italy's first choice keeper. I got you.
No, go ahead. No, carry on. Sorry, carry on.
Hold up. So Zoff was Italy's second-choice goalkeeper. Albertosi had actually picked up an injury in the first leg of the quarter-final against Bulgaria. And although he was fit for the finals, he had to make a decision over whether he felt he was fit enough. And in the end, he went with Zoff. And if you look at the footage in those finals, Zoff has got the number 22 on his back. And he's very much the standing goalkeeper. And he's at fault for the Yugoslav goal in the final as well. So to get through by the skin of the teeth almost in the quarterfinals, to have to rely on the toss of a coin in the semi-finals and then come from behind to force a replay. It was only really in the final replay that Italy really kind of like took a stranglehold and said, right, no, we're going to win this and we deserve to win it. And there were like five changes to the side that were made for the replay. And it is one of those fascinating things. And one of the great things for that tournament as well, it's like the first major tournament, certainly involving a European side, that has the iconic Adidas Telstar. You know, it's got the wonderful Telstar. So there's a degree of kind of like, you know, that seismic change from the old world to the new world. You know, the football is slowly turning into the new. You know, you're on the cusp of the colour television era. You know, the footage of these finals are in black and white, but within 2 years at Mexico. You know, it's a modern game. It's colour. It's the Telstar ball. But there's the Telstar ball in '68 in black and white in Italy as Italy win the European Championships. And yeah, '68 I find an utterly fascinating tournament. You know, even down to, you know, Paul's mentioned the qualifiers. You know, West Germany, first time that they first time that they entered the tournament and they lost in the qualification group. You know, they had this epic failure by going to Albania, Tirana, and drawing 1-1, which denied them the place in the quarterfinals. And, you know, there's something brilliantly reassuring about Germany's, you know, failure in that 1968 European Championship as well.
I'll just jump in. There's one thing unique about that tournament as well, Stu. So in 1960, the third place, fourth place playoff attracted 9,000 fans in France. 4 years later, it attracted 3,000 in Spain. In Italy, there were 68,817 fans watching the third-place playoff when England beat Soviet Union 2-0. And the simple explanation for that was the final was played on the same day in the same stadium a couple of hours afterwards. So the people who watched the third-place, fourth-place playoff actually were there for the final as well. Now, whether if Domenghini hadn't scored that 80th minute equaliser for Italy, they would have wrecked the place, who can say? But it's interesting that there probably will never be beaten that 68,000 fans watch the third, fourth place playoff in the European Championship.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that's an incredible stat, isn't it? And, you know, I suppose at the time that was actually quite a good idea, because the replay would have taken place midweek, I presume, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's 2 days afterwards.
Yeah. So to get the crowds in there, I mean, because if the third and fourth place games are played at the weekend, only attracted 3,000 in the last competition, you hazard to wonder how many would have attended otherwise in Italy, playing the game in the midweek.
In fact, the final replay, there was less than half of the fans that attended the first game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, obviously, clearly, Stephen, Gary, we've been working far too long. Your comments there, Stephen, I was just about to ask Paul, before we move on to 72, and I was going to ask Paul, you know, you look at the thing with the flip of a coin, you look at the third place playoff, you know, on the same day as a final, and I was just about to ask Paul, you know, is this the last of the, not amateur game, but the last of the sort of amateur versions of this tournament before we hit 72? And I was going to ask Paul what his opinions were of that.
Yeah, I think so, Stuart. I think it kind of ties in with what Stephen said before as well, that the advent of colour TV, the fact the European nations were attracting a more pan-European audience with more sponsorship and things like that, massive, huge television figures. And I think, I mean, I'd have been, 13 when the 68 European final took place. I've no recollection of being covered on British TV. I'm sure someone could prove me wrong on that, but I just don't remember being shown at all. Whereas by the time you get to 72, these things are starting to be... So by the time you get to 72, these things are being covered in a lot more detail, a lot more depth. So I think there's a definite move from the so-called amateur game, because you can't have a live semi-final on TV being decided by the toss of a coin. Can you imagine that now in the modern-day era, you know? And, you know, maybe... And, of course, you know, in the past, they'd use things like drawing straws, hadn't they, instead of tossing the coin for progression. And even at the European Cup, tossing the coin was still an accepted method of qualification until about the mid-60s. So, yeah, I think it marked the end of the almost semi-professional way UEFA was managing the competition. And, of course, with the increase in numbers as well from competition to competition, there's no way a situation could be allowed to occur where you'd have two games in the same stadium on the same day and also have the toss of coin deciding who progresses to a final, not a knockout stage, a final.
It is unbelievable. Okay, so we're progressing along nicely on our travels around Europe and the political upheaval and tossing of coins and rock, paper, scissors and all the stuff that's gone on to decide these games. Stephen, I'm gonna come to you for 72. You know, we've chatted when we talked about the World Cup and the 74 West German side, and a lot of people like to discuss the merits that the 72 side was actually a better side than the side that won the World Cup. So I'm going to come to you, Gunter Netzer, West Germany, in Belgium. Over to you.
Oh, yeah, 72. I mean, there was the West Germany kind of like of 19... You can go to the 1970 World Cup as part of this, really. A free score in West Germany that made it to the semi-finals, played that iconic semi-final against Italy that ended 4-3, and they scored goals for fun. But it meant that they were that little bit looser at the back, and they weren't as watertight and helmet shown. By the time they win the World Cup in 74, it's with a much more resolute side, much more German, and kind of the Germany that would... It kind of emboss itself on the psyche for a generation from there on in. And this 72 West Germany side kind of goes forgotten because it is right between the two polar opposites of those two versions of West Germany. And it is all down to Netzer. You know, Netzer, you know, it was the great enigma for West Germany. You know, wonderful player for Borussia Mönchengladbach. Stylish, un-Germanic, one of the most un-Germanic German players ever, in a similar way and thinking to the way that Bernd Schuster was, you know, that he had the temperament of a Latin European player or a South American player almost. You know, he didn't have that team ethos first and foremost. It was about himself and then the team second almost. But Netzer was a wonderful player and he made everything tick for that West Germany. And he was kind of there by less so design than more error possibly or by chance, because it came down to injury at the end of the day, and West Germany and Helmut Schön were without Wolfgang Overath, who was a more, you know, a skilled player but a much more disciplined Fleur player, the perfect Helmut Schön type of player, and he was so pivotal to West Germany winning the World Cup in 1974, but as part of a much more disciplined framework. So the West Germany side too, without the injured Overath, it just gave Netzer this freedom that, you know, yes, there's no Overath, I am going to be playing, and they built this team. And Netzer was in so many ways like a German Cruyff. He was the German answer to Cruyff. And he was a wonderful, wonderful footballer, very skilled. Vision was absolutely excellent. Drop deep to collect the ball and create and be able to carry it. And you know, he just had absolutely everything, but he had this suspect temperament. But in 72, he was in the perfect place to be able to show the full range of his skills. Playing in a Borussia Mönchengladbach side that is rising to prominence.
Yeah, me, Stephen, I mean, I think you've really summed up Netzer well there. And certainly, I remember watching the 72 game when they played England in the quarterfinals. And Netzer, it was the image, wasn't it? The long, flowing, blonde locks, the touch on the ball, selling dummies to the England players, spraying the ball about, making time for himself. He just looked absolutely superb. And I remember going to school on the following Monday, and everyone, when you were picking the teams, wanted to be Netzer. You wanted to be like Netzer. For the first time, a German player was someone you emulated to be. You didn't want to be Muller particularly, anyone like that. But Netzer, it was like the rock and roll image, the era of glam rock, those long flowing locks. He just looked a pop star playing football.
He was absolutely everything. He ticked all of those boxes. He was, you know, one of those superstar players. And this is where, you know, the 1970s are so conductive to this. You know, George Best from the 60s into the 70s, that superstar element. And Netzer was of that ilk, and Cruyff and all of those. And, you know, these players that just become icons, you know, because of as much the personality as the football themselves.
Yeah, that's right, Stephen. I think as well, it also, for me, it marked a time shift in perception of the game in the UK, whereas we kind of grew up on Alf Ramsey's wingless wonders, and it was kind of being jumped into us, that clogging, you know, Don Revy's Leeds United, to some extent. Teams were obtaining Arsenal, the double-winning team in 77 as well. Teams were winning honours by playing a dull, turgid style of football. And this German team, you watch them, thought that's how football should be played. That's what it's all about. Outplay the opposition, turn on the style, turn on the panache. You know, and you know, Netzer, you know, he was the pop star, he was the playboy, he was everything that if you're a teenage lad, you wanted to be.
He was, and I think he must have stuck in the, you know, in the psyche for you know, impressionable English viewers. I mean, they beat England in the quarterfinals over two legs. A 3-1 scoreline. And I've sat and watched, you know, the vast majority of that game, you know, retrospectively online. And England were kind of like almost an equal of that West Germany side for about 80 minutes. But yeah. That added element of Netzer was what took it away from England at Wembley that day. And what a player. But, I mean, one of the interesting side effects of that defeat for England was that had England reached the semi-finals, then they would have hosted the 1972 European Championship
finals. That's right, Steve. The significance was it signalled the end of the Ramsey era, and so, you know, the most successful manager in English history had gone. He'd been bypassed by the times almost.
There's a couple of things I'd like just to chuck in there if I can. That's, I remember Gunter Netzer playing against England in that 72 qualifying game. This was obviously a couple of years after the 70 World Cup, where England got beaten after being 2-0 up against West Germany. And you think, you know, as a naive England fan, you're thinking, OK, we're going to put these guys right now. It's going to be at home. But I think West Germany won 3-1 at Wembley.
Yeah, they did, yeah. 3-1 was, yeah.
And Netzer was this... And I think a guy I can relate to, and it's a different game, is in rugby union, David Duckham, who's playing for England. He had this sort of... This trailing blonde hair behind him. He's like something like a spirit from another world that he could create... carved sway through defences, almost with just a sway of his hips. And Nets had this quality about him. Steve describes him magnificently well, of course, because Steve does these things. And he was like a South American rather than a European player. And he had this quality that sort of made you want to be like him. And it was a wonderful quality that he had. But in the finals, it's worth mentioning that... West Germany played two games in the finals, I mean, the semi-final and the final, and Gerd Müller was the difference in that tournament. He scored 4 goals in 2 games. And, you know, this guy was obviously... This is a couple of years after the 1970 World Cup and before they won the World Cup in 74. But Gerd Müller was in his prime then. This was the arch goal scorer. They had Netzer, who was the majestic midfield player. And they had an emphatic goal scorer, goal poacher. He scored all kinds of different goals. And it's difficult to imagine West Germany not winning that tournament.
It's can I throw... this is what happened... I was just going to say... I was wondering, this is what happens when you leave me too much thinking time. Obviously, you know, listening to you guys, you talk about Netzer, and that's all fine. But I feel like I need to ask a question. Any of you can answer it, because it's fine. And this is a four-team finals tournament. You know, we've talked about Denmark qualifying, and, you know, in this edition, it's, you know, it's Hungary who are perhaps, you know, or maybe Belgium, perhaps the outsiders. My question to any of you is where were the Dutch?
The Dutch were
sorry.
You primed me, haven't you, Stuart?
I figured it would come to you, Gary, but I thought I'd throw it out to anyone.
The Dutch were still a poor side these times. They didn't never qualify for the major tour. They lost 2 successive finals and they didn't qualify again for about 12 years. I think that's right. But they were like a flame that burnt really, really brightly, but only burnt very, very briefly. And Steve mentioned earlier about, I think it was Steve mentioned about Luxembourg knocking them out of the European Championship the time before that. But the Dutch weren't that great a team then. And we'll come on to the Dutch later, I think, when we'll talk about Czechoslovakia in 1976. But they weren't a great team in that sort of stage. They were just beginning to be, but they weren't fully developed, shall we say?
Yeah, I think as well. I mean, go back to what you're saying there, Stu and Gary. I mean, the Dutch didn't even make out the group stages at that time, did they? I think they're in the same group as Yugoslavia. I think they finished second in that group, so they didn't even make out the group stage. And I think it's quite interesting to kind of compare the impact club teams have on the national teams, because at their pomp, Feyenoord at their pomp as well, so they are the best in Europe, but the national team is nowhere near that. Whereas for Germany, although like Mönchengladbach was starting to come, you know, to make progress in Europe, the national team was way ahead of the club sides in Germany, so almost Holland and West Germany were kind of reverse images of each other at the time in terms of the club football and the national team.
Dead right, mate, dead right.
Brilliant. You see, I knew I had the three best people to ask. That's great. My curiosity is satisfied, as hopefully are the listeners who are wondering where the 74 Dutch side were and why it only took them 2 years to be as good as they were. But that's all right. Okay, so we're on the hour mark, and we're sort of heading across to Yugoslavia, and we come to, again, without spoiling the surprise, Czechoslovakia win it. How they win it is perhaps the most... memorable, the most important out of the tournaments that we've looked at so far in terms of finals. I'll throw it open this time. Who wants to kick us off with 76?
I'll jump in then.
Go on then, Gary.
I'll jump in. Yep. Okay, so do Czechoslovakia, it. I remember for one particular penalty in the final, but let's not divide this team. This was a decent team. We talked about the Dutch a little earlier, and they beat the Dutch in the semi-finals 3-1. And this was a Dutch team that they had Sorbia, Rijsbergen, Kroos, Neeskens, Janssen, Rep, Cruyff, Van der Kerkhoff, Vreemdenbrink, Van Hanegem on the bench, Jan Peters on the bench. Any team that beats the Dutch team with that many quality players ain't no bad side. So when they beat the Dutch 3-1 after extra time in the semi-finals, that's a great result.
Paul, I just echo what Gary said there. I mean, bearing in mind the world force of Holland were at the time, and you know, I think the Czech national team by that time were kind of on a bit of a downward trend. So for them to come through and beat the Dutch in that semi-final, and then to beat the West German team in the final, I mean, maybe that achievement never quite got the credit it deserved, because you know, West Germany were almost unbeaten at the time. I guess that was kind of their first defeat in a competitive game for a long, long time.
Yeah, and it's also worth mentioning the final there. Although, you know, we all remember the Panenka penalty, the Czechs were 2 plonk up in the final as well. And the Germans came back and then we equalised in the last minute of 89th minute when Holzenbein scored. Otherwise, the Czechs would have won it in normal time anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, you realise who the referee was for that game, don't you?
I do. It was Gunilla. The guy who refereed the World Cup final when Argentina beat the Dutch. Is that right? Am I right?
Well, you may be right, Guy. I've got a feeling that might have been Clive Thomas of Everton-Liverpool semi-final in 1997.
Vanilla, mate.
Was he? Yeah.
Clive Thomas did one of the semi-finals.
He did
one of the semi-finals.
I'm pretty sure that's the one he did, you know.
The Czech-Dutch game, the 3-1 semi-final, but the final was Sergio Gonella.
That's what I meant. I meant the Holland-Czechs about the semi-final.
Yeah.
It was definitely Clive Thomas. Yeah.
Go ahead, Stephen. Go on. I was just gonna add to that, you know, the praise for Czechoslovakia was that they came back as well from a poor start to the qualifying. The first game was a 3-0 defeat to England at Wembley, and Don Revie's, you know, the dawning of Don Revie as the England manager, who had a promising start, no matter what came later on. But they turned it round with a victory over England in Bratislava later on in the qualifying competition. Which was Portugal. So to turn that, you know, defeat around, that could have just, you know, marked the rest of the qualification campaign for them, that to come on so strongly and do what they did in the finals, you know, because they were just so strong in the finals. You know, as has been mentioned, they came so close to winning the final without having to go through to extra time and penalties, and they were dominant against that fantastic Netherlands side. They were deserved winners. You know, they won 3-1. They actually scored all three goals. It was a quite a spectacular own goal that brought the Netherlands back into the game. Yeah. And there was no fluke about that Czechoslovakia winning any games and winning that tournament. They were a wonderful, wonderful side. But what they were is that they were a surprise element, because there was no signs of this in the build-up to 76. They didn't qualify for the 74 World Cup. They hadn't been, this, you know, they weren't at the 72 European Championships. They'd been to Mexico 70, but gone out in the group stages playing England and Brazil. So they were an unremarkable side prior to this, but there was a slow build-up, but it was a pronounced spike because they didn't reach the 78 World Cup. They failed to reach the 78 World Cup. Scotland and Wales, they fell by the wayside. And they're a peculiarity in that respect, because they were so good, yet it was just a brief spike, a brief flash of brilliance. It was not part of a wider odyssey or a wider dynasty.
It's funny. Right, can I just ask...
Stephen,
I was just going to ask.
Of course, Jim.
Again, I'll come to you, Paul, with this. Do you think that it's, you know, Steve just talked about there, and you know, we've talked all the way through this. You know, like we've talked about this spike of teams for this particular tournament and getting to these finals. And do you think that it was the nature of the tournament, the fact it was four teams, you only, I say only, obviously you had to qualify, but once you were there, you only needed two victories to win the tournament. Was it the nature of the tournament that allowed some of these perhaps unexpected victories?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, too. I think, you know, it's obviously a lot easier to make progression in a tournament where there's only four teams compared to, you know, the four-week process of the World Cup or the European Championship these days. And, you know, you only have to give two good performances and you've won the competition. So, yes, certainly that helped. I also think as well that so there was less pressure on teams in those days going to competitions as well. And certainly from the country like Czechoslovakia, they were under no expectation, even at home, to win. So maybe because there was no pressure on them whatsoever, that helped them to perform better as well.
What you've got to throw into that as well is just how good that Yugoslavia side was as well. They've done so well at the 74 World Cup. They were the host nation. You know, in their semi-final, they'd been 2-0 up against West Germany before they'd thrown it away. Into, you know, it was midway through the second half that West Germany turned that game around. You know, 25 minutes to go, Yugoslavia are 2-0 up, but it contrived to lose 4-2 in extra time. You know, that was a fantastic Yugoslav side that was powered by Belgrade players of that era. And you know, Czechoslovakia were the rank outsiders, won it. But to win it so deservedly against such a strong field and to have come back in a group containing England and Portugal, you know, I think it's one of the great under-celebrated stories because of the manner in how it is, again, with Panenka's penalty, the penalty shootout, and the shock that, you know, a German national side has managed to lose a penalty shootout, which, you know, they just never go on to do ever again, forever and ever and ever.
No, that's right, Steve. It's the first time a penalty was given a name. The first time in football that a style of penalty actually got its own name. That has lived on for nearly 45 years.
Yeah, and within that, this amazing penalty from that decides it somehow takes away all of what got Czechoslovakia there in the first place.
Yeah,
and I think that's the biggest tragedy of that, if that's not even the right word to use, because they win the tournament.
Yeah.
But so much of what was great about that Czechoslovak side is shielded. It's masked by that Panenka penalty.
Yeah, I think as well, part of that is I don't think many people in the UK actually watched that final, with it being West Germany against Czechoslovakia. It didn't have the same pull as one of the home nations being at that stage as well. So it didn't quite get the coverage it deserved. And consequently, the Czechoslovakia didn't get the credit they deserved for what was, by any, you know, by any measure, an absolutely incredible performance.
He's a bit of trivia to sort of... somebody likes pub quizzes. In 1976, the guy who scored, who was the top scorer, had the same name as the guy who was top scorer in 1972. 1972, the finals, top goal scorer was Gerd Müller. In 1976, it was Dieter Müller. A little bit trivia there, so anybody likes pub quizzes. And it's interesting that the Panenka penalty was the one that won the tournament, because Hernes failed to convert from 12 yards. And obviously, you know, the Panenka penalty, and it's not a Pirlo penalty or any other name. It's not a Zidane penalty. No. It's a Panenka penalty.
Yeah, that's right, Gary. Stu, can I just go back to the qualification stage? Well,
yeah,
because I think it's only right that we mentioned Wales. Wales were the only country from the home nations who qualified to the last days, and they came up against the team Stephen described before, and these are Yugoslavia, who were a really, really good team. And they lost the first leg 2-0, I believe, but they really fancied their chances in the second leg, and they were the victims of some quite awful refereeing decisions from an East German referee, and they ended up losing the second leg as well. But it was some achievement for them with the squad that they had to actually get through to the quarterfinals, and until the most recent Euros, I think that was the best Wales had done in a major competition
Yeah, it's a massive irony, really, because you consider it's the last 4-team European Championship, and years later, the introduction of an 8-team tournament, and Wales put in that qualification group performance, then they would have played in the finals of an 8-team tournament. And, you know, considering all of those wild misses on qualification that were to follow for Wales, you know, 76 almost feels like they're being goaded by the tournament.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. It was a moment in time, wasn't it? You know, if they had progressed and made it through to the final stages, how the course of Welsh footballing history could have been different.
Yes, completely.
It is. I mean, before we sort of close this off, I think it's also worth mentioning here at 1976. I mean, there's sort of four games. It's 3-1. It's 4-2. It's 3-2, and then 2-2 in the final and penalty shootout. And tournament football, and you have the group stages, and sometimes, you know, it can be such a turgid affair just trying to get out of the group. But it seemed to, you know, the 4-team tournament, certainly in the 76 one, it just seemed to bring out almost a joyous brand of football.
Oh, there's a brilliant freedom to it. I mean, a friend, acquaintance of mine, Haider Jawad, who wrote for the Liverpool Echo, the Times, all over the place, and he was probably the age that me and you, Stu, were at the 82 World Cup. And that he was at that age, and he always talks about how there was about a 3 or 4 week span, and it was just the most wonderful 3 or 4 week span of football that he ever lived through, because there was Liverpool winning the UEFA Cup. As a Liverpool fan, for him, that was brilliant. But not just that, the style of the games as well, because Liverpool came back from 2-0 down in the first leg at home to win 3-2, and then it was a very tense and dramatic second leg in Belgium. You had the European Cup final where Saint-Étienne were going for it against Borussia Mönchengladbach at Hampden, the square post being hit. And it was just a massively, massively impressive. And then you also had West Ham reached the Winners' Cup final, they lost to Anderlecht, and then there was this European Championship. And it was Panenka, and it was the Dutch, and it was West Germany, and it was Yugoslavia. And he just absolutely will regale you about it and just say that it was just the most brilliant month of football that he lived through. He just absolutely adored that month of football, and that European Championship to offer 19 goals in 4 games, just wonderfully attractive football, and the sense that anything could happen. It was just the most fitting way to end the 4-team tournament era of the European Championship.
Brilliant. I mean, obviously, like you say, we have sort of come to the end. We've travelled through 5 editions of the tournament, and you know, things will start to sort of slow down a little bit as we progress through the series. But I suppose I want to ask you. Well, my first question again, I'll put it out there: is did the early editions? Is it fair to say the early editions belong to Eastern Europe? I'm aware, you know, Spain have won it, Italy have won it, West Germany have won it, but, you know, was it a more Eastern European dominated finals, if you like?
I'd agree with that, Stu, and I think it goes back to our original point that without the participation of the Eastern Bloc countries, the competition would never have got going. So I think it's only very improper that the Eastern European countries are given the proper credit for it. And of course, you know, it's no Eastern European countries yet won a World Cup, have they? So in some ways, it's quite good that they left this legacy with the European Championship.
Gary, would you? That's a great point, Paul.
I think within that, I was just going to add that. Yeah. I think the great thing about the European Championship is that there is almost, although, you know, it's a massive tournament to win, there isn't that sense of a World Cup. Is that there is a, for the teams that feel like they can win it or they should win it, there is a sense of failure. There is a fear of failure that sometimes permeates into the football. And I've always found it with kind of like a perceived lesser tournament bringing more entertaining football out of it than the more stellar tournament does. You can point to so many more classic League Cup finals than you can FA Cup finals in the last 25 to 30 years. You know, you can kind of say the same about the European Championships with regards to the World Cup. you know, so often as well, UEFA Cup finals and Cup Winners' Cup finals were better than European Cup finals because of that fear of losing the biggest game of that strand of football. And I think that remains one of the most blessed things about the European Championship, is that nations all seem to relax into it far easier than they do into a World Cup.
Yeah, I think as well, Steve, to develop your point there, it's never been quite as jingoistic, has it, as what the World Cup competitions have been as well. It's slightly lower key from both the fans' perspective and the country's perspective, I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just a much more relaxed tournament for players, for coaches, and for spectators. You know, it doesn't mean that they don't want to win it or they're not invested in it. You know, they are, but I just think that all the conditions, you know, pan out to a tournament that is just enjoyed on a much more subconscious basis than the World Cup is.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm gonna throw out a final question. It's gonna be the same question to all three of you, and I'm gonna ask you first, Stephen. So you get ready, because this is kind of your series. So you be ready. Okay. Paul, you get ready, and then obviously Gary as well. But okay. I'm gonna ask you for the. Obviously, we've covered five tournaments, which covers multiple eras over, you know, sort of over the best part of 20 years. But if you had to put a name to those early editions. Who would you associate most with those early editions of the tournament?
gotta go with Panenka, because, you know, who else gets a penalty named after them? You know, and to win it for Czechoslovakia, you know, we're talking about a team that did compete in two World Cup finals, so it's not the only thing they ever did, but just to win it in the manner that they did against the team that they did in a colour era with an Adidas Telstar, the last tournament to be played with an Adidas Telstar with a major tournament, it would be handed over to the Tango at Argentina 78 and onwards. It just had so much that was evocative to it, and while there is the other stories about it. You know, if I'm thinking of the 14 European Championship, then it's Panenka and Czechoslovakia.
Okay. Paul, you are more than welcome to pick a political figure if you so wish. But which figure is it for you? Which name for you for those early editions?
Well, obviously, in terms of the political spectrum, it has to be General Franco, both for his lack of participation in 1960, but also for hosting competition in 1964. But if you ask me to name one player, I mentioned before about the Eastern Bloc and the importance that the first competition was to be a successful competition for it to gain momentum and BVPs subsequently. In the final, when the USSR beat Yugoslavia 2-1, it went to extra time, and the goal scorer of the winning goal, I think you pronounce this, Pane Danik, scored the winning goal for the USSR, and apparently before the game, the Russian team were really nervous before they went out for the final, and the team doctor came and said, relax guys, Pane Danik's going to score the winning goal, and he did.
Brilliant. Obviously then, Gary, over to you. You get the final say. Who for you would you say is the name that you most associate with these early editions?
I mean, it would be difficult to argue with Stevie's nomination of the player that typified that. I'd have to go with Panenka, not because he was a decent footballer, and he was, not because Czechoslovakia beating West Germany was an emotional moment for anybody who watches football, but it was. But this was a guy who did something different. And he did it in the final of a major tournament. And, you know, some people argue, and I'm one of them, would say it's easier to win a World Cup than it is to win a European Championship, because there's far more competitive teams in European Championships than there are in World Cups. It's an arguable point, but I think it's something that I would probably think is true. And so for that reason, I would go with Panenka.
I've got to say, fellas, considering you spent the best part of 15 minutes eulogising over Gunter Netzer right down to the length of his hair, I'm stunned that none of you have mentioned him. But that's all right. That's why we're here. It's all about opinions. Guys, thank you so much. I think a great first episode. Hopefully the listeners got to enjoy it as much as I did. Like I say, I had a ringside seat to that, and it was wonderful. It was really, really good. Paul, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Stu. Really enjoyed it.
Good, good. Gary, as always, again, and obviously we'll be speaking to you on the next one as well, but I think a good start.
Definitely, mate. It's great to have somebody like Paul on board for these early. His knowledge has been fantastic, and obviously his passion for the game comes through in his conversations. Well,
thanks, Gary.
And Stephen, obviously your brainchild. happy with the first edition.
Oh, happy with the first edition. It bodes well for the episodes to come. And like you said, it'll feel maybe a little less a million miles an hour, because it should slow down with the next episodes. As what we're going to do is we're going to bracket two tournaments together, because the tournaments expand. So episode two is going to cover 1980 and 1984. But this was just brilliant. This felt like the podcast, football and podcast version of The Empire Strikes Back. It was wonderful.
Oh, I've got a lot of time for that answer. As Stephen mentioned, we return with 80 and what is essentially my favourite edition of all time, 84. But it's, like I say, it's been an absolute pleasure, gents, as always. And all that's left for me now is to thank the listeners and ask you to please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.